Blog Talk Radio.
DJ Black Season, how are you, dear brother?
I am doing pretty good, Sister Gidget. I am doing wonderful. How about yourself?
I am so nervous, but a live kitchen, and we're going to get through this night. Oh, well. Okay, let's get started. Thank all of you who are in the chat room. Thank all of you who are on the line for joining us tonight. This is a very, very special interview for me because one of my heroes is on the line with us tonight, and I am so grateful for his presence. And so we're going to start by opening up, and then we're going to go to Minister James Muhammad out of Tampa, Florida, who has been so gracious to join me on this special night. And assalamu alaikum, Brother Minister James, are you there?
Wa alaikum salam. I'm here by God's permission. I want to extend the greetings to DJ Black Caesar, to you, Sister Gideon, and of course our esteemed and famous guest, Brother Malik Farrakhan, as well as to our online and listening audience. Thank you for allowing me to be a part of this show. So, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam, and thank you. Okay, well, we're going to get started. In the name of Allah, the beneficent, the merciful, I bear witness that there is no God but Allah, and I bear witness that Muhammad is his messenger. I bear witness that the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan is our divine reminder tonight and every day. I greet all of you, and I'm listening. I greet the words of peace. Assalamu alaikum. Okay, y'all can tell I'm very nervous. Okay, so, Brother Malik Farrakhan, assalamu alaikum, sir. How are you?
Walaikum salam, sister. I'm fine.
All praises due to Allah. Okay, before we start the interview, Brother Malik, I'm going to let Minister James, who is really the orchestrator of all of this, share a story with us. How did all of this come to be, Brother James?
Yes, ma'am. Also, with the name of Allah, beneficent and merciful. You know, Brother Malik, last week, as you know, I contacted you, and this was as a result of Sister Gidget and I having a conversation about the movies in which you happened to star. And she began, before we can even talk about the movie in length, she began to go on and on about how, as a young girl, and she admired you, particularly in that part that you played in Sparkle. And you were Mr. Satin Struthers, I believe. And she had just went on and on and on, not hardly letting me get a word in edgewise. And so finally, when she took a breath, I said, you know, I know my brother. I know our brother. She said, you do? I said, yes, I do, and I have his number. I could contact him for you if you'd like. I mean, she was so excited about it. But let me share with you what she shared with me, and I won't say all of it because I can't remember it, but what I do remember is that she shared with me after having viewed you in that very popular film, Sparkle, she began singing all of the songs of Sparkle, or that Sparkle performed, and my sister, whether you know it or not, has an angelic voice, very beautiful voice. And so when her schoolmates heard her sing, they put her in a show wherein she had to perform all of the songs of that particular movie. However, she was motivated by her great admiration of you, dear brother. And so when she found out that I was able to contact you, that I knew you by the grace of Allah through Public Enemy and, of course, through the nation, I told her that I would call you. When I called you and you shared with me that, yes, I could share your number with her and tell her to give you a call. Brother, when I relayed that information, I mean, she was just so excited. It appeared as if she was going to come through the phone. So I had to calm her down. And then, of course, the rest is history. She did contact you. And as a result, we have you on her show tonight. So take it away, Sister Gidget. Your dream has come true by Allah's grace.
Thank you. you. Thank you, Brother James. Okay, Brother Malik, I'm officially embarrassed, but I think you already know I'm a big fan of yours. And so, Brother Malik, why don't you introduce yourself and present yourself to those who may not know you very well, and introduce yourself to others that may be a couple of generations behind and not too familiar with you. Tell us something about Brother Malik.
Well, first of all, I want to thank you all for the support and the love for the movie and the performance. And I want to pay particular homage to Brother Minister and his family. And I hope they're all well and of health, and all the other members of the Nation of Islam throughout the world.
Praise be to Allah.
I feel honored, and I'm happy that I'm able to give you an interview. You know, so I have no problem about it. I'm no better than the next guy. I'm another brother. I just have done other things, and maybe some haven't. And my affiliation with the Nation has been a wonderful blessing for me. I'm honored to speak to the brothers, as well as others that are listening.
Wait a minute. I'm sorry. We're getting some feedback. So if you have your computer on, or if you're on speaker, can you come off of speaker?
Hello?
Yes, sir.
Testing 1, 2, 3.
Okay, we can hear you.
Okay, sound okay?
I'm still getting some feedback. Hold on 1 second. Okay. All right, go ahead, Brother Malik. I'm sorry.
Testing 1, 2, 3. Test 1, 2, 3. Everything is off here. I'm just, no TV, no nothing is on, just the lights.
Yeah, I think I found it. Okay.
Oh,
go
okay.
ahead.
Okay, but my name is Malik Farrakhan, and a.k.a. Tony King. I was born in Canton, Ohio in 1944, and I was raised in Alliance, Ohio, which is, you know, maybe 18 miles east, I guess, of Canton. And that's where I grew up at, with a brother and a sister. There's three of us, a year between all of us, and a mother and a father, Charles and Georgia King.
Yes, sir. Okay. And what was that like growing up in the 40s? And, you know, a lot of black people particularly are from the South. But what was it like in the North in the 40s and 50s growing up in your time? Was race relations still an issue, or what was going on back in your childhood?
Well, race have always been an issue, you know, and I think it's going to be an issue as long as we wake up in the mornings, unless we do something about it. I don't think, regardless of how much we do, it'll change, but I don't ever think it'll go away. In Ohio, Alliance, Ohio, where we grew up in a small town of maybe 31,000, and we're famous for the genie from Alliance, the device that opens your garage door, and the knuckle that holds the two chains together. That was the main plants in Alliance, Ohio, Alliance Machine and American Steel. My parents worked for both of those companies during, you know, our growth. My father was a military person in the United States Army, and he had an honorable discharge with many awards and salutes from the Army, the Gold Star and all that kind of stuff. And he and my mother were both, you know, superb athletes, especially softball. They went to Canton McKinley High School, and they left school in the 11th grade. But they were both fine athletes, you know, playing ball at that time with the great Marion Motley from the Cleveland Browns. And my mom ran track with him, and beat him twice, I'm told, in the 110 low hurdles. And my father played football with Marion Motley, and they left that and went into the work world, and they raised us. And we had a tough time in school. It was, I think the racism was there, but we didn't realize it because of the books that they were directing our attentions to, at least the books that we had to study from. They were racist, but we didn't know it. Probably most of us couldn't spell racist at that time. But, you know, we were getting taught things that didn't really ring a bell. They weren't true, like the Statue of Liberty and who did that, and lies about Dr. King and J. Edgar Hoover and history in general. You know, they never gave us any credit as to what we accomplished, which is history in itself. And so We went to school, you know, we studied and we got the grades, and we listened to the teachers, we respected them. We practiced football on a daily basis because football was introduced in Canton, Ohio, and so everybody thinks and loves football in that particular area. So our parents, you know, raised us, and we took us to all their ball games as little kids, and we went to elementary school when, you know, just stupid. We weren't wealthy at all. You know, we was on welfare, I recall, for a lot of years, but we survived. Mm-hmm. Our mother and father made sure we had clean clothes, things like that, and we were manageable. And our father, all he requested us is to take care of our chores, you know, at home, and we could practice ball daily. Now, I think he knew he had two athletes at that time. He really did. And as we older now, he's since passed 93, but we realized his skill and wisdom and how to take care and protect us and make sure that we were good athletes. You know, he sent us to certain trainers to work with, people that he trusted, the Grimes family and the Nicholson family, both from Alliance, Ohio. So there was never a clash. And then Dan Cherry, who was our trainer, he made sure that all those areas were covered during our, you know, growing up. And we never got in a lot of trouble. I don't think there were gangs at that time. If there were, we didn't know anything about it. You know, we played on, you know, little mopeds and motorcycles and things that we could put together and make, turn our bicycles into, you know, motorbikes, put little engines on them. So, and then when we got to be 5, 6, 7, let me see, no, I take that back, maybe 8, 9, 10, we moved to Detroit, which was like, you mm-hmm. know, really like a horror story. You know, we didn't want to leave Alliance where all our friends were. But, you know, at that time they were hiring at General Motors and everybody's fathers were running to Detroit to get jobs. So we got caught up in that little scuffle, and we lasted maybe less than a year. And before we had to come back home, we got in fights every day. And we won some and we lost some. And we finally got out of there, and then we got back to Ohio, and then we grew up there in Alliance. Like I say, a population of maybe 31,000, and we went to school with black and white at Alliance High School. And I think the listening audience, what a lot of them may not realize, is that we graduated 12 professional athletes, all from the same high school, coached by the same coach, Mel Noton, who's since passed. But all of the players, I think, still living to maybe one or two. And that's a heck of an honor for a school of maybe 450 people. And six, seven of them were black, and the other guys were, you know, Caucasian. And I'm thrilled and honored about that circumstance and situation. I hope it'll get some historical work. But we grew up like normal kids, you know. Like I say, we were poor, but we managed. Our folks took good care of us, man. Like I say, they made sure we were clean every day. And we led a good, you know, school life. And then we went into high school, and Charlie and I were like, you know, good athletes. And our father, you know, he trailed us every day and told us things to do every day. And we got through elementary school. We got through junior high school. High school, our high school years, we were both like All-State. He was All-State in 60, 61, and I was All-State in 62. And he went on to Purdue University, and I went to the University of Findlay up in Findlay, Ohio, near Bowling Green and Toledo. And
what did you major in?
I think we did all right under the circumstances.
Well, when you went to college at Findlay, what was your major?
I was majoring in speech and a minor in history. I like to talk, so I just figured it out. Get some speech courses. Because I knew I was going to be speaking somewhere, somehow, to somebody.
Yes, sir. And so when you chose that major, what was your goal? I mean, did you want to be a teacher, a college professor? I mean, when you started selecting your major, what did you think your future held at that time?
I wanted to play football. That's all I wanted to do. I didn't think beyond that. I didn't want to be a doctor. I didn't want to be a nurse. I didn't want to be a mailman. I didn't want to be a pilot. I didn't want to be an aircraft carrier. I wanted to play football. I wanted to punish people and get punished at the same time. That's all I wanted to do, is play football. And that's what he programmed us to do. Although we played, you know, baseball, and we ran track in high school and stuff like that, and we excelled at all sports, basketball, but football is what we really wanted to do. And like Jim Brown was our idol growing up, and you know, other players too, but he's right there in Cleveland, So, you know, we used to all wear number 32. Sometimes we get in fights. Every time you come out on the field, everybody got on number 32. So that drew arguments every day. But, you know, we got past that. We got through it. And then we just played. And we never got a chance to go to Cleveland to watch him, see him in real life, although I'm very close with him right now in 2013. But he was what we looked at. He was the cornerstone of you know, just Jim Brown. So we just all felt that we were going to play football. And our father, you know, like I said, he and my mom played softball all the time, so they would take us to the game, and we would watch them, you know, and they were hardcore athletes, and they're both excellent, superb athletes.
Yes, sir. And now tell us, I know already, but share with the listening audience who you and your brother Charlie are, because you all are living history.
Well, thank you. We are the first African-American siblings to play professional football on the same team at the same time, the Buffalo Bills in the 66-67 season, primarily 67, because I was on the cab roster in 66, but we played together in the 67 season. And then we got traded the following year for when O.J. Simpson came. They sent us both to Cincinnati, and Paul Brown didn't want to deal with brothers. You know, when I say brother, from the same parent. So they sent me to the Giants, and I ended up on their farm club or something. But, yeah, we never really realized that it was going to be any kind of history. We've been playing with each other all our life anyhow, so we just thought it was just something to do. And during the his senior year and my junior year in college, Charlie got drafted by the Buffalo Bills and the Baltimore Colts. And I got drafted by the Bills and I think Dallas Cowboys. And so Mr. Gallagher, I can recall, in 1965, I think, he came to our home in Alliance at 1140 mm-hmm. Garwood and knocked on the door and identified himself as such. And my father was there, my mother, brother, sister. And he came in and he started talking about Charlie. You know, and I was happy for Charlie, but I was kind of upset too at the same time, because I respected my athletic ability as I did his. But he was a senior in college and graduated, and I didn't. I left my junior year in college due to a lot of racial flaws there at the university, and I just got tired of it, so I just left. And then I was home, and they signed my brother to a contract there in 65 at our home. And so after they signed, I recall hearing Mr. Gallagher say that he had to leave and go to Erie, PA to sign another athlete. And so my father, you know, being the genius that he is, he said, look, I got another son that's just as fast as Charlie, but he's bigger and he hits a lot harder. You know, why don't you sign him? And so Mr. Gallagher kind of like came back at him and said, well, you know, our assignment was here to come in to sign Charlie. You know, so my father jumped, pounced right on him and told my mother to go get the Johnny Walker Red. And she went and got the Johnny Walker Red, and they had a couple of drinks, and they continued to talk about signing both the King brothers. And so eventually he got to the phone to call Ralph Wilson, who was the owner of the Buffalo Bills, and still is. And he told Ralph about what my father said. He said, he got another son here, Antonio. He's a big guy. He said, he's just as fast, and he hits much harder than Charlie. So what do you want to do? And so he said, well, look, sign them both.
Wow.
So that was some history, and we were just tickled to death. You know, we really were. Our brother got a no-cut contract with, I think, maybe $20,000 bonus, and I got I don't remember what my contract was. I would have played for free at that time, but they gave us about $7,000-$8,000 bonus, and we just went to bought cars and, you know, got the girlfriends and rode around town and listened to all the he-rah, the King boys, and finally made it. But they would see us practice all the time, you know, out in the streets, snow, rain, sleet, it didn't matter. We practiced. Every single day we practiced. So we look forward to that particular day. And the money, I guess, was just for all the hard work that we did. And so, you know, we gave our family some and things like that. And then I went back to school to try to, you know, see if I could finish up. And that didn't work. So then we came back, and then we just went on into the Buffalo Bills opening season there in 66, I think it was 66. And so years went by before we realized that it was a historical thing. You know, we just, like I say, we were brothers playing together all the time, and that's how we looked at it. But it was real history, and they honored us in the NFL Hall of Fame. In 2008, they gave us an exhibit as the first brothers. And at present, we're trying to make it stationary permanent. You know, we don't need a gold jacket, but it's a fact, and they have other factual things in the Hall of Fame that compete with what we're talking about, like Art Shell is the first African American coach and things like that. And we played against him, so if he was the first African American coach and we were the first players, then why aren't we in the Hall of Fame permanently? So, but, you know, we'll get past that. You know, we'll deal with the politics of it, and hopefully, you know, Allah bless us to be in the Hall of Fame permanently as the first brothers.
Well, you make sure you let us know if we need to
yes.
petition for that or whatever we need to do, because we want to make sure that that happens for you and your brother Charlie, because that is history. I mean, that cannot be redone or anything like that. You and your brother were the first, and that's just the way it is. And so now, after all these years, Brother Malik, how do you feel about that, and how does your brother feel about that?
Well, he lives in Selma, Alabama. You know, we talk every day, and he's unhappy with the stats of it, and we've talked to the Hall of Fame about it, and eventually we just have to step up the pressure, and they have a black person that runs the Hall of Fame right now, Steve Perry. So, you know, I don't want it because he's black. I mean, I'm glad he's black, and I'm glad he's running it, but it would be nice to get it under his tutelage, you know, and he and Charlie are much closer than he is with me. And so maybe it'll happen, maybe it won't, you know, but like I said, we're going to push forward to it, and I know I got some help from you on the radio, so, you know, hopefully we can get it done in the next year, so maybe tomorrow, I don't know.
Okay, all right. And so, when did you leave football?
I left football in, what, 71, 72, I got traded around a lot, you know, I was beginning to think I was just like meat on a stick. I can recall the most, after we got traded from Buffalo and I went to the Giants, and they would never let me go up on the big team, you know. I don't know if they thought maybe I wasn't skilled enough to do it, but I thought that I was. And then they sent me to Denver Broncos. And so I was happy about that because I figured, oh, wow, I guess we're going to get a chance to play a lot now. And so I recall coming to camp, into the dressing room and you know, got us uniforms and clothes and stuff. And at that time, I recall asking one of the assistants in there, could I wear two pair of socks? Because that's what I was used to wearing, was two pair of socks. And that's the time when the tube sock came out. And I didn't like the tube sock, you know. I wasn't trying to be different. I just like wearing two pair of socks. Because I've been wearing two pair of socks. Every time I put on kind of athlete sneaker or a football tee, I have two pair of socks on. And so they made a big issue about it. And so I said, wow, man, I just got here. And I remember my college roommate was there, Odell Berry, and what's the quarterback? Marlon Briscoe, one of the coaches from the Chicago Bears, I recall, was there. And he seemed to be a very fair individual as a Caucasian. And so I asked, could I have two trainers tape my ankles? I think I got 2 years in the league. I could ask a couple of things that I want. And so they made a big issue about that. I said, man, all I'm asking for is, because, you know, that's important, your ankle taping, because your feet get numb if the tape is on there wrong. And what you going to do on a football field if your feet numb? And so they made a big issue about that. So I got kind of irritated. And, you know, I can't remember what I said, but I'm sure it wasn't pleasant. And then I went to the dressing room after the first practice session, and somebody knocked on my door. I'm trying to figure out who's knocking on my door. So I peeked in the peephole, and I recognized him as being one of the ball players, but he's on offense. And it's not really protocol for offensive players to come knock on a defensive player's door. They got this side, we got our side. They got their book, and we got our book. Offensive books are always much larger than the defensive book. So I opened the door and let him in, and it was, I think his name was Highsmith, first black center, I'm told. I don't know if that's 100% accurate, but it could be. But anyhow, he said, what you doing? I said, I'm reading about Malcolm X. And then he left the room kind of like immediately. As if like to run and tell. Oh, this nigga's reading Malcolm X. And I don't know if he said that or did that or not. But I know they came in my room in about an hour or two and said that I had been released. So I got in and borrowed one of my buddy's cars, you know, because I was just hurt. You know, I started crying, to be perfectly honest. And I got lost. I ended up in another state, I think, and the sheriff stopped me one time with the little smoky bandit hats on and asked me what the problem was, and I explained to him, you know, he said, oh, no, you're way off that young fella. Got to take this route, blah, 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 to go back here. And I did that, and I got back, and the guy whose car I bought, quite literally, he was upset, you know, and I explained to him, you know, told him I apologize. And they give you, what they do, they give you a ticket to a team that you may want to go to, a one-way ticket. And I think I asked to either go to the Browns or Oakland. And I think it might have been Oakland because I ended up playing up in Seattle, Washington on a farm club that the Oakland Raiders owned. And I think I played a season there, maybe two. And then I transferred to the New York Giants, and they put us on their farm club, which was in Long Island. So I think I played there about 2 years. And then I just, to be pretty honest, I got tired of the racism. You know, I thought I was a good pro athlete and that I should play a lot more than I was playing. And so I just left it alone, very bitter, you know, at the game, at a lot of the coaches, a lot of the racism. And Buffalo had a ton of them on their team, you know. But I recall the ones that weren't, like Marty Schottenheimer, Jack Kemp, Tom Sestak, Marty Schottenheimer, and another the defensive end. His name was, what was his name? I can't think of his name. But these guys were real characters. They were good guys. You know, they never called us nigger, you know, and they were probably the only four or five that didn't. Got to thinking that that was your name after a while. So, you know, I came out the game real bitter. And then I just went and caught a train to Hollywood. I seen Fred and Jim do some movies. You know, I said, well, I guess I'll go get in a movie since I know them guys, and I'm sure if they did it, I can do it. So I just flew to New York and started walking up and down the streets, avenues, you know, with different clothes on, things like that, trying to get a job. And a lady yelled out the window when I was on 45th Street in New York. Hollered out the window, hey, how you doing? I said, fine. I'm yelling back at her. She said, can you act? I said, yes, ma'am. And I went up to her office there, and husband was sitting up there with a little poodle. I'll never forget, man. He's sitting up there with a little poodle. I said, damn, what is this? So she said, hi, my name is Ernestine McClendon. I said, hi, my name is Tony King. And she said, I teach acting and blah, 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 blah. I charge $150 an hour and blah, 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 blah. I said, okay, fine. I'm live. And so I started right there. She went and got an onion and banana and something and let me just smell them and sense them. And I started crying when they put the little onion up in my face. I said, damn, I don't want to do no movie and cry. So I kind of thought, like, is that what it's about? So she never saw me again after that. I left and started walking the streets of New York. And they were filming a movie over there on 8th Avenue in the 50s. And I walked up to the director. I said, man, why are you shooting over in our neighborhood and you don't have no blacks in the movie? He said, you want to be in the movie? I said, yes, sir. He said, well, all you do is ask. Come on. And he took me in there and, you know, gave me some clothes, some wardrobe. And I found a sister that I knew. I said, come on, you want to be in the movie? Come on, come on, come on, come on. And we came up in there, and we had a scene in the bar there with Jane Fonda and Donald Sutherland. I think the film was called Clute, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah, Clute. And then from there, you know, I just hustled. You know, I just hustled. Walked the streets, found out where they were shooting movies at. And sometimes you get over and sometimes you don't. And then I end up doing a commercial there for PepsiCo. And I won a Clio, which is, you know, which is the Oscar of commercials. And after that, I started getting calls, getting works. I signed with an agency there in New York called Black Beauty, ran by a lady named Betty Ferrey and Carol DiRiganza and Dee Gibson. And I started modeling and, you know, going on for movies. And me and Richard Roundtree was like two, maybe the top models during that time, especially advertisements. He could wear the 40 regular suit. I couldn't, so I didn't get to do too much of that fashion stuff. I was a big commercial artist, always like on the billboards and stuff all over the country. And so I just, that's how I got started. And then eventually I started getting bigger films, you know, Shaft, Hell Up in Harlem, Bucktown, Report to the Commissioner, Sparkle, French Connection, Clute, Godfather 1, Hell Up in Harlem, The Toy. I did a bunch of films, man, 34. Then I moved to Europe and Italy, and I worked over there for a while. I moved to the Philippines, and I worked in that circuit for a while. And then I came back to New York and opened up a makeup company, and I did makeup. I was always fascinated with, you know, doing makeup, female faces, and, you know, get some girls too at the same time. But I just did a lot of things, you know. Didn't really know exactly what I wanted to do, so I just tried a whole bunch of things that you knew that you could do. And, you know, I just got, like I say, I got bigger in the film market, and maybe around 92, 93, I just got tired of going to interviews. You know, I figured they know your work by now. Just call you and say, look, I got a job for you. You know, but that's part of it, right. Interviews, you know. So, that was on me. That I'm not faulting the industry. That's just how I felt. You do enough of something, somebody should just call you up and say, hey, look, blah. But it didn't happen like that for me all the time. Every now and then, Fred, he'd give me a call for something like that. But we should have worked like Clint Eastwood and his friends do. Every film you do, man, bam, there we go, and everybody get paid. So I just did the films that I did, and I moved around the country, and I worked overseas, and, had real big success over there. I was top box office in Asia in the late 80s, so worked a little Hong Kong circuit, and, it was okay. I was enjoying life and doing what I wanted to do, and I thank God for all the things that, places that you've been and done and never got in any trouble and, never got hurt. So now, I may do a movie every now and then, something come up that I lack, and I feel I'm qualified.
Yes,
I'd be more than happy to do it.
But can you tell us, Brother Malik, where did the acting ability come from? I mean, because growing up, it seemed like you were always involved in sports and athletics. So where did that craft of being able to act come from?
I don't know. My father said that his father was an actor. He worked on the train, as a porter. But Daddy, I remember Dad saying that your grandpa Emmanuel, he was a big actor back in the day in the Bardville and all of that. So I don't know. I'm, like I say, the only class I went to there was with Ernestine for that day. And I don't know. I don't think acting is all that hard. You get to train, go to classes and stuff. Sure, they help you with certain roles, I've never done theater, so I don't know what that's like. I was just always interested in films because I know you had another chance to do it if you messed up. So I don't know. I photographed well during that time, and I wasn't arrogant, I knew what I could do and I knew what I couldn't do. And I functioned like that. If they'd asked me to do Shakespeare, I couldn't do that. Then it's not what they asked me. So the films that I've done were films that, I liked, I enjoyed. And, a lot of them I was the villain. I didn't have no problem being the villain. I knew what I was like in real life, and I ain't never, hit my wife or nothing like that or beat no female. So it was a movie, and that's as far as I took it.
Right, and then I wanted to know, did you feel like you were stereotyped, or did you ever have a desire to want to play other than the tough guy? Because I know all the movies I've seen you in, you were a straight-up gangster. You were so sick with it, you were very convincing. And then to get to know you, to know that you are totally opposite of that. So did you ever have a desire to play any other kind of roles, or were you just comfortable? Were you in your zone playing a gangster?
I was comfortable, but I always wanted to do other type films, But, that's not what came to the agency. Every now and then we talked about some, and I always had the option of saying yes or no. So the ones that they may have offered, I just maybe didn't like. I wasn't going to be no butler. I wasn't going to be no punk. I wasn't going to do none of that kind of stuff. So I don't know. I don't know. If natural is the right word, then so be it. But there's a lot of luck in it. I was always good with people. I always had good manners. And I knew what to say and what not to say. And I got along, and that helped a lot. Like a lot of the directors, like the late Milton Katsalas, Ossie Davis, late Ossie Davis, does all the Lethal Weapons. I can't think of his name right now. But anyhow, I made a lot of friendships, even with commercials. Joe Picker, who's probably the top commercial director in the business, and I've done like 30 commercials for him. National, international commercials. So I had a blessing to be photographed real well, and I was good looking, and I knew what to say and what not to say, and I kind of got into the clique for a while. And if I got blackballed, I don't know nothing about it because of the Farrakhan circumstances. But I never let that be a hold up for me. That's what I wanted to do and was going to do regardless of a movie and some money.
Yes, sir. And let me ask you, who was your favorite actor or actress, and did you have an opportunity to ever work with them?
I got to work with Ossie, his wife, who I respected. I still think to this day she's just a gem. You give her one line and she'll turn into a whole movie. She's just Ruby Dee. I have a lot of them. You know, I like Pacino, man. I like Robert De Niro. I like Sidney Poitier, James Earl Jones. I work with James. I never got a chance to work with Sidney, although we're good friends. And I work with some real big-name people in the business. You know, I don't have the list in front of me, but I work with a whole bunch of them in films, commercials. So I was where I was supposed to be at the right time.
Okay. And so let me ask you, because so many of our actors that were back in the black exploitation film, that's how they kind of categorized those films, like Superfly and Hell Up in Harlem and Truck Turner and Shaft, those movies during that time. Unfortunately, a lot of the actors had some form of, you know, substance abuse or even tragic deaths. However, in talking to you this week, I learned that you just never journeyed that path. And I wanted to know, you know, because you were, you know, a phenomenal actor. How did you avoid that? How did you avoid the drugs and the alcohol addiction and all of the other things that seemed to plague so many of our young black actors back then?
Well, when I was 10 years old, my father made us drink a glass of vodka and eat an R.G. Dunn cigar. So that killed that. Yeah, that killed that right now. As a matter of fact, I can taste the R.G. Dunn cigar right now as we're talking on this telephone. I taste it every single day of my life. And as I got in the movie industry, got bigger, I tried to smoke the little reefer one time, and it made me feel like I was moving too slow. And we tried the little cocaine, made me look like I was too hyper. So I always had the ability to just say, well, hey, I don't need neither one of those two. And I left it alone. I lost a lot of friends, though, in the process that weren't as strong. But I definitely give that one to my father. And because he, like I say, he was very, 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 very tough on us. He sent us through a training process, man, that you just don't want to smoke. You're too tired to smoke, too tired to go get some water. He had us running mountains, pushing trains, pulling rubber tires. He made us practice in the street, man, during the traffic hour where we had to concentrate on the ball, the curve, and the vehicle. So, you know, we got to the pros, we were prepared. You know, he did a remarkable job. And sometimes I stop and wonder and I ask myself, man, where did he get all of that from? Because we didn't have any lawyers, nothing like that, to help us with the contract, to make sure we wasn't getting cheated or getting beat. We never had anybody come to us and talk to us about investing land and this and that. And our kids is busting their butts going to college, taking courses that they never get to use when they get out, or the ones that they do graduate with, they go use it for the white man and not with our own people. You know, so it was drama, man. It was drama. You know, the black exploitation films come out. Who brought up the term black exploitation? We sure didn't. And that they made Hollywood. They saved Hollywood. Some of them survived and kept doing other films. And, you know, but I've always felt like, hey, man, we made it possible for the Denzels and all the other little great actors, you know, because we fought through it. I remember going to interviews with Sidney Poitier and Brock Peters and Ivan Dixon, and all of us are dark-skinned. And that's going to always be a problem in the film industry, you know, always. As a matter of fact, let me read you something that I think will sum up that whole question about the racism. Harry Belafonte said it. And Halle Berry, Harry Belafonte is a gem. A gem.
Yes.
Like G-E-M. Hollywood has yet to explore the breadth of black experience. And the industry will never yield to the needs of people of color, artists and activists. We are responsible as blacks for changing the way the entertainment industry represents people of color. And until we do that, it's going to be like it is. I mean, that's a perfect, accurate statement and distillation from a man that has been there, from Dr. King till today. He didn't take no short road. And if you don't believe me, you pull up his bio, and that's just a part of what he's all about.
Oh, yes,
sir. Yeah, the racism going to be there. These little player reality shows, and I ain't player hating, you know, I'm glad they're working, you know, but they where they going, where they taking us, you know? You still don't see the black actor working, the dark skin actor. I you think a dark-skinned girl feel going to an interview with 10 light-skinned girls? And I ain't knocking light-skinned girls because my wife is light-complected. I'm just telling you about the industry. That's what we were talking about, not husbands and wives. But, yeah, that market came through here. We all benefited from it. We all did the movies, tried to make the little dollar, and that's all it was a dollar.
Well, I'm going to tell you something, Brother Malik, whether you know it or not. You know, we have Denzel, and we have Idris Elba, and we have Morris Chestnut, and these are the brothers in the film industry today that we look at and we say they have swagger, right? Well, brother, you know you are the godfather of swagger, because nobody was cooler than Tony King, nobody, and you dressed to the nines, you hear me? You was, look, let's say sharp as a tack. You were always so clean, always so cool. And so I think, in my humble opinion, I think that these young actors actually study, and now I know they do, because I know Denzel actually studied some of Superfly. He studied Fred Williamson. He studied you in some films before he actually played Training Day. And, you know, to develop that kind of swagger, brother, you are the godfather of swagger, whether you know it or not.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I like all those people that you just mentioned. I really do. I respect their work, and I don't look at it as who's the best and who's the this, who's the that. We did what we did when we did. I would hope that thought is the same thought of we made it possible for a lot of football players to want to play ball, and I would like to think the same thought in films. You know what I mean? I don't go to the movies a lot right now, but I always like Denzel work, and the gentleman that you mentioned, I like all of them work. I really do. And I don't think there's a best, you know, because they give the awards out. When I say they, I'm talking about the Caucasian person. You know, Denzel gets an award for being beat up, being killed, being a fool, rather than getting an award for Malcolm X, when she was just superb. You know, so, you know, it's and I'm thankful and I'm glad for those that have won Oscars and things like that, but, you know, it's tainted. It's really tainted. It's tainted. I'm glad for Will Smith and his family. I'm glad for all of them. You know, I'm glad for the work that I did, you know, and if I get a chance to work again, so be it. I'll be the same brother that I was before, and I hope I've gotten better and wiser and more articulate, you know, and it's a real touchy business, you know, and there's a lot of things going on right now, a lot of reality stuff, man, and, you know, somewhere along the line, we got to really establish who we are and what we want to do and do the things we want to do, and not just comedy all the time and rapping all the time and naked girls on the screen all the time. And, you know, that's just, you know, it's I don't know, it's just everybody wants it fast now. They want the gleaming, name, the this and the that. And, you know, rap is going to take them to another place. And you can just, if we take 10 of the top rappers, man, we could change the whole economy. You know, but they're not getting that kind of training. They're not getting taught that Jay-Z is, 50 Cent is, and a couple others. You know, respect them to the bottom of my heart. You know, but that's what we have to do. We got that kind of power. They just don't realize it.
So are you saying, Brother Malik, that if the Black Actors Guild, so to speak, would take a stand and take control of the type of film that is being produced and how we as Black people are being portrayed, if they just took a stand and kind of redirected the direction of the films and the type of film, that we could get a better product out of Black Hollywood?
Sure, I think so. I think so. I mean, they probably wouldn't be able to get the money as easy as the Caucasian, you know, because they run that. They run that. You know, you come to them with a project, you know, and they won't give you the money. Just like, let's say, Wall Street, the story on Wall Street, which is where a bunch of whites drop bombs and everything on all the blacks and kill them all down in Tulsa back in the day. You know, that picture hasn't been shown yet, you know. And a lot of them, you know, just they don't have the capacity they want. Ice Cube's doing a marvelous job, and a bunch of other little young directors, man, that's really on point and do good film. But it's easier, you know, they're going to always present you, I would think, with some action that's color-orientated. And if you don't have that sound mind where you want to do better than what somebody might offer you, then you're going to just take what they give you to do and just go on down the road. I mean, I don't think all the films I did were famous or great films or non-black exploitation. You know, we did them because that's what was available.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. But
well, it's not
going to
change until they make the adjustment.
But I know you also shared with me, though, just like you just shared with us earlier, that there were just certain things that you would not do. You know, you would not play a punk in your language. And, you know, there was just certain things. You wouldn't play a butler or anything like that. Then you stood your ground. You took your option to say no. And I think a lot of us are just saying yes to the money. And, you know, we are selling our souls and our dignity and our pride out for the dollar and for just the recognition and what they think is fame. But I think fame is when you're able to make a decision and you're able to portray something of quality and value that's going to span through generations of time. So, you know, prayerfully, we'll get there, Brother Malik. And I want to give Brother James an opportunity, if he wants to ask you a question, because I know he's going to have to leave us in a few minutes to attend to some business. And Brother James, before you go, I want to tell you publicly, I thank you for connecting me with one of my lifetime heroes, and I can never thank Allah enough for you just for being my brother and my minister and my friend, but certainly for this great opportunity that you have afforded me to connect with Brother Malik. And is there anything you want to say before you depart from us, brother?
Well, first of all, I must confess, and all praises are due to Allah for whatever He uses me for of good, that I could bring some joy or facilitate bringing some joy in the life of those whom I love, my brothers and sisters, especially you, Sister Gidget. And But I'd like to make a confession that while, you know, I mentioned about your preoccupation with my brother, I have to say to you, Brother Malik, I have always admired you. And you were somewhat of a, not a mystery, but someone of an object of attention. One of the reasons is because of your name. I knew how sacred that name was and is. And I know how very, very, very choicy the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan is in terms of people wearing that name, believers wearing that name. So when I heard your name, I said, wow. First, I thought you were a member of the family before I met you or saw you. And then I said, well, what is special about this brother that the minister has given him his name? I know he's very, very slow to allow people to wear that name. And so that created a curiosity for me. And then when I realized that you were an actor and I began viewing some of your films, when they were showcased, I was trying to make the connection, but I always was very curious. And then when I got to meet you through Public Enemy, I've been a long time brothers with them, particularly Brother James and the S1W and Pop and all, and, you know, most of them, and Chuck and Griff. In fact, I was blessed to be a part of the video Fight the Power when it was being filmed in Brooklyn with Spike Lee. So when I got to meet you and saw how warm, you know, when you have this elevated perception of someone, but when I got to meet you, I said, this brother is very personable, very humble, and easy to talk to. He wasn't the kind of person that carried whatever fame or notoriety or attention that they were given and get in life on their lapel. So I'm very happy to hear that. And you know, brother, I can't even necessarily remember how we established the warm relationship that we have. All I know is it happened. And I want to say that I'm very thankful to Allah for that, dear brother. And I want to encourage you in your endeavors. In whatever you do, I pray that Allah gives you all of the success in the world. And yes, you did pave the way for others, whether they say it or not. We know it to be the truth. And before I go, I'd love to hear about the transitions in your life, the transitions from what we've heard about sports and we're hearing now about Hollywood and the film industry. I'd love to hear about your transition to the nation, as well as becoming the head of security for Public Enemy. So I'm going to stop right there. I do have to go and tend to something, but I certainly love to hear what you, your comments on that, dear brother. Thank you, Sister Gidgen. Thank you, Brother Mallet. May Allah bless you, dear brother.
Thank you.
I look forward to seeing you when you're here.
Yes,
I think
sir.
You told me that you're going to be in Orlando. When is that? In June?
Think,
did you say June?
I think June. We're in St. Augustine and St. Petersburg. Orlando is another project, something totally outside of Public Enemy and the thing. But we have a film situation down there with what it's called Dakota P Productions. And I
Versa
her mom, that we have access to studio facilities down there to shoot videos and films like that. So if something comes up, you need to do it in Florida, just let me know. But anyhow, as far as the transition, I never was really a church person, you know, as I was growing up. You know, and when I was older, I used to go to when I became film star, I used to go to Chicago just to hear the minister, because, you know, we had heard and listened to his tapes and things like that. So I was flying in there every Sunday just listening. They would introduce me, and he would mention my name, and we'd come up and say hi to the flock and brothers and sisters, and I'd go back and forth. And then finally, man, he just said something that just beamed in on my propensity toward life, violence, nonviolence, life, death, all of that. And I just said, okay, fine, this is what it be. So I just changed my name, and then when I came to the mosque again, they told him that the brother changed his name, Brother Minister, and the minister approved it and okay, and so then I kept coming to Chicago, you know, being a part of that, and the people at the mosque, they treated me real nice, and I was always nice to them. I didn't never make them think that I was better than them because I was on the screen. I invited them to my residence with me and the wife and eat and things like that. I just wasn't a real different person, you know, that they ran into a lot with other stars. They treated them differently, and I just wasn't like that. And during that time cycle, me, Bernie Casey, and Jim Brown were probably the real, you know, like far as figures that you see on screen a lot. You know, we was with the minister. I was never afraid to be with him. You know, I didn't care what another race of people thought or felt about it. You know, I knew that he was the one. And I just said, well, okay, this is where I'm going to be. And I got the name changed. And we went through all of that. And then I started working with his security and protocol team. And I got busy, you know. And I guess he felt like, yeah, if a guy is going to turn down $200,000 to $300,000 a movie just to come work with me, you know, he's either crazy or he's just a good brother. And I said, well, I'll take that latter. And so that's how that happened, you know. It was such an honor to meet him. And the first time I got to meet him in Phoenix at his home, I was like sister here. Sister said that when she was 13 and she had this flash, when I was like 40-something and I was in a polyester suit in Phoenix, Arizona in 110-degree waiting to meet the minister, and I almost burned up. I said, he might not get to meet me, but I might burn up out here in this polyester. But I'll tell you, man, it was the highest honor that I could have accomplished during that time. And then since then, he and I have been really, you know, close. You know, I'm close with the family. I'm part of the family. I got the name, and I'm just an adopted son. And he has really been remarkable. And he told me to take care of Public Enemy. It wasn't something that I was looking for to do. We was rushing to get his wife to an airport one night at Midway Airport in Chicago, and Public Enemy just happened to be there when we were going out, and Mr. Farrakhan told me to take care of these guys. And I've done that for 24 years, and I've taken care of those guys, especially Chuck D. So I'm honored that I think I've worked for two of the finest men in the world, and I don't mean to compare Chuck D with what Minister Farrakhan is doing, but you understand what I'm saying as far as I've been blessed to work for two fine, remarkable. And without a doubt, Brother Farrakhan is just the apex of all of that, and he has been just a wonder of the world, and they owe it to themselves to leave him alone.
That's right.
There's definitely repercussions. There is definitely repercussions for messing with him. Just leave him alone and listen. And I'm so thankful. I heard about the stuff at the colleges of recent, especially Tuskegee. You know, when he went, you know, just, I mean, you gotta hear what he's saying. You just gotta hear it. And his I mean, being with him is more important than all of the Public Enemy stuff, all of the movies. That stuff is secondary. And like I say, Chuck has really been a powerful warrior. And
oh,
he
yes,
has listened
sir.
To the minister and his fight, his articulation of the words. You know, we've been political ever since we started. We ain't changed. We fought for Dr. King holiday. We fought for other things. You know, just we fought and we've been there. And then going into the Hall of Fame later this month, we had to fight for that because they didn't want they wanted to tell us who they wanted to introduce us. And as far as I was concerned, I told Chuck it was Farrakhan and Belafonte. And I know y'all don't want the minister to do it. so Belafonte, I guess, has got the honor, and we're thankful to that. And we're thankful to that. So I just call the minister and tell him what we plan to do, because on the 16th, 17th, and 18th, those are the days of the Hall of Fame events in Los Angeles, California. And I think on the 16th, we're going to do our thing and do our friends and stuff. And 17th, we'll do a big show at the Rock and Roll. No, we do a show at the House of Blues. And then 18th is the induction. And then we leave the country on the 19th for Dublin, Ireland. And we'll be overseas in Ireland and France and UK until maybe May 2nd. Then we're back in the United States, and we pick up with Cool and the Gang. Not Cool and the Gang, but LL Cool J, Ice Cube, and De La Soul, and we do a United States tour from May 20 on to July 7th. So
that's excellent. I know Sister Paulette is going to be rolling with you, brother. And I'm going to try to be a father as much as I can.
Yeah, bless her. Thank her, man. She's been such an assistant to me. You know, she's really been on top of things, and her mindset is fine, and her work background is just complimentary. I mean, I look forward to seeing her every time we move.
Yes, sir. That's one of my daughters. She called.
Oh, great. But yeah, but that's how that happened. It happened just like that. It was just It's been a blessing. My family is close with them, and my wife and my son, my daughters, you know, so it's been a wonderful relationship, and I don't look forward to go anywhere. I mean, I'm not going anywhere. I don't get to go to all the big conferences anymore because, you know, PE, we just on the road. But I'm doing what the minister asked me to do, and I think that's the best I can do for right now.
And they are great blessings, I'm sure.
Oh, they're just honoring
his request, brother.
Yes. They we love him. We talk about him every show, everywhere we go.
Oh, yes, sir.
We talk about him. Yes, sir, because they're definitely afraid of him. And they ain't afraid of him. They're just afraid of the truth that he tells. That's what they're afraid of, because they done lived under a lie, and as well as a bunch of other odd people. Just, you know, but he bringing it straight and direct. And if you want to hear it, listen. If you don't want to hear it and you want to die quick, then don't listen to him.
Go ahead.
Just be on the course. But it was a nice transition. It created some hassle in my house, my mother and father. You know, when I first made that adjustment, you know, they were kind of like really down on me. You know, it hurt. It was very painful. That's one of, you know, I've had a couple of pains in life, but that was that hurt to hear them talk about him like that. But I knew that it was because the white man that laid it out there like that, and you listen to the white man rather than listen to your brother. And so then they fought, and I said, Mom and Dad, I tell you, man, I'm just going to have to divorce from my parents because I'm going with him. I'm going with him. You know, and then my dad, he really got paranoid. And I said, look, I tell y'all, he's going to be in Dayton in a couple of weeks. Let's go. And you judge for yourself, Dad, Ma. And I took them to Dayton, man. We sat there, man. They had to go to the bathroom all night. They ain't went yet. Whatever they held up, they held it up to the throat. And then after it was over, they said, son, I'm sorry, Dad, you don't have to tell me. You don't have to apologize. You heard it. Now they're trying to get in the dressing room to meet him. I said, man, the minister tired, Dad. We meet him another time. And then as time came by, he got to meet him. And my mom have been together, you know, induction three or four times. So, yeah, it worked out. It all worked out. And I'm thankful that it happened. And I'm glad that they're back on path. And, you know, that's, what can I say? It's been a good life. I mean, if it stops tomorrow, my wife would say, he lived a good one. He did a good one. Just put me in a box, man, and play Minister Farrakhan, Michael Jackson, and the OJ's hero, and just show pictures and let me go. You don't have to put me in a water, dirt, dust, nothing. Just put me in a box, because I done lived. I done been to maybe 98 countries. I don't never have to stay in a hotel unless I choose to, and I got friends all over the world. So I'm blessed.
All praise to Allah. Very beautiful.
Well, Brother Malik, I thank you so much, man.
Oh, you're welcome, brother. Thank you.
And Sister Gidget, thank you so much for inviting me on the show. And listen, please give the brothers, Brother Chuck, Pop, Rip, Flav, all, and of course all the S1Ws, give them my love and greetings. I look forward to seeing you as soon as you're in the area and
yes,
Allah
sir.
Permits. Thank
yes,
you
sir.
Again, and may Allah bless you, brother. With
thank you so much.
Success.
Thank
I'm
you.
I'm going
thank
to greet
you.
All of you now with the greeting words of peace. Assalamu alaikum.
Okay.
Walaikum salam, sir.
Walaikum salam, Brother James, and thank you. Okay, Brother Malik, well, I think Brother James might have took some of my questions that I had for you.
Sorry about that.
But let me ask you, though, when you first met the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan, what did he say to you?
He was honored to meet me. He singled me out there in the palace, and my work said he had seen some of my films, and his kids had talked about it, and my football background, and he was just thrilled to have a person of my background in his capacity, you know, in his so-called stable. My whole thing was that I figured with my celebrity status, how I could help him get to some places that maybe he couldn't get under normal circumstances. No disrespect mm-hmm. to what he can and can't do. Just this was a different kind of business. It's film business, you know. And he worked it. You know that he met all the fine actors and actresses. You know he knew them because he was an entertainer, and he had to let that go to do this. Allah's work, God Muhammad's work, and Elijah Muhammad. So it all worked out, and. But it was just a highlight, you know. It was a highlight. I had never met Jesus, but I think I met one of his sons. So that's good enough for me. That's good enough for me. So it was really an honor. I mean, it wasn't like meeting no president of the United States. It wasn't like meeting the president of Bosco Candy. It wasn't like meeting the president of the NBA. It wasn't like meeting Jim Brown or Bill Russell, whom I have total respect for them two athletes right there. And because there's very few people shirt that I'm going to put on with their face on them. I'm just not a person that's going to wear anybody's stuff, you know. So Jim Brown, Bill Russell, and Chuck D, Mr. Farrakhan, they can get it from me. I wear a shirt with their face on it all day. But that's just me personal, you know. There's a lot of other great people that deserve you wearing a shirt, but I'm not there yet. But it was a blessing. It was a blessing. And I didn't make it like no spirit thing or, you know, he's somebody that you can't feel, can't touch. He got a heartbeat and a pulse like the rest of us. He just ain't no punk. That's what he ain't. Yeah, I don't care what the circumstance is, he ain't no punk. He gonna tell it just like it is. If you lack it, fine. If you don't, that's fine too. You know what you can do. So
take it or leave it alone.
Yeah, I knew he was real. He was real. Yeah, so all they can do to make him look bad is try to set him up with some stupid stuff. But other than that, you know, he's the one.
So what is the best advice he's ever given you, personally?
Mr. Farrakhan?
Yeah.
Wake up. If you wake up in the morning, like if I wake up tomorrow morning, I have a chance or option to do anything I want to do if I wake up. And he's told us what to do. So if we don't do it, that's on us. Because he done told us a thousand times. He done told us. So if I just wake up, that's the best advice I would give to a little youth. I don't be telling you, you don't have to go listen to Brother Farrakhan to be positive or be real or to get a good job or take care of your family. No, you don't have to do that. You just have to wake up. If you don't wake up, you can't make any kind of commands. So that's the best advice he gave me. Wake up in the morning. And then those things that I've said that relate to you, you utilize them. Farming and the land and you know, just things that, I mean, we done built this country, you know, and now we just out here shooting at each other, man, going crazy. And just, I mean, slavery has hurt in so many ways. So many ways, you know. It's just the crime. The crime that's going on is just ridiculous, man. This is Chicago and New Jersey and the different things that have happened on the TV here recently. I just try to instill kids, man, to pull your pants up, man. Where are you going to get a job with your pants down below your ass? Unless you're working for your own people, and that's still wrong. You know, it's just, and they could make him so much bigger than he already is, but they're just hard-hearted, man. They're just hard-hearted. And the TV don't help. The rap don't help. And the minister loves all the rappers. He just don't love what come out their mouth. And I don't either. You know, we love them, man. They are people. They can alter this. They can make his job easier. But they hard-hearted, too. They hard-hearted, too. So the jewelry and the Cadillacs and the big homes and the other things and the drugs got them. So we just have to just, you know, keep busting our butt to try to change it. Keep talking to these youth. You know, I mean, I try to go back to Ohio on a regular basis and talk to the kids at school because I never had a black person come to our class and talk to any of us from kindergarten all the way through college. Not one black person ever came through there to tell us about us. So I make sure I go to the school. Every time I get in the line for how I go dead to the high school and talk to those kids. And some of them don't believe you until they pull up that computer. They'll say, oh, damn, he ain't joking. You know, so but I go. I want you to know, man, that you can get here. You can get here, man. I'm a positive to you. I made it through all of this that you're going through now, Alliance High School. You got the same books that I had. That means you're learning the same stuff that I had. And I didn't know who I was till I got in the nation. I was just a guy named Tony King. Who is that? I said, hell, let me just change it. I don't want to know now. I change it to something that I know. You know, so that, you know, that's all you can do, man. If you talk to 10 and you get 2, you are a blessing. But you just have to keep doing it. And a lot of times, it's who come talk to them. You know, some people talk to them and they really listen. They understand. And there are others that talk to them that they could care less. So, you know, I don't try to be a caregiver or nothing better. I just try to treat them like I would want to be treated. And that's what the minister has stared into us. And, you know, those that follow him, that watch him, that study him. You know, I've been there with him since 81. I watched him, studied, listened. So, you know, I'm a student. I'm not a student of the book or the Quran. But, I mean, I know what he's talking about. And I know what I can do, what I can't do. And I can't don't exist. You just go do it, man. You just pull your shoes up, man. Pull your pants up and just go for it. Because it's there. It's there.
Well, you know, I got this brother on the line that wants to talk to you, and he's inboxing me talking about he's scared to talk. But, brother, I'm going to call you our brother Frank. You can call in and talk to Brother Malik. I can bear witness. Brother Malik is your brother. He don't play that big eye, little you stuff. He would be honored to speak with you, Brother Frank. So... Brother Frank say he's shy. He wants to say something to you. And I'm going to give the listening audience an opportunity, if you like. You want to ask Brother Malik a question. Those of you in the chat room can type it in. Those of you on the phone, press 1 on your dial pad, and I will make your mic live if you have questions for Brother Malik. But Brother Malik, I want to get back to you say I was wrong. We love you, Brother Frank. I want to ask you, you said that you chose the name Malik, and what does that name mean, and why did you choose it for yourself?
Well, Malik means king, I'm told, and I've looked up and said, but it's just, I just like the name. I didn't think of Malcolm X. I didn't think of Malik Shabazz. I don't know, the name was just around, and I don't know, it just sounded good to me. Not Malik, Malik. Minister called me
right,
Malik. So that's what it
right.
is. I ain't no Malik. Malik sound, well, that's all right. I don't want to get into that. I'm Malik.
so really and truly, since Malik means king, it means king in chief, I think, or something like that. But really, that's your last name, so you just changed it to the Arabic version.
Yeah, right.
Okay, Brother Malik, I'm gonna get off your name. And so let me ask you. So when you changed the name, and with you still being involved in you know, the film industry, now your level of involvement in the music industry, because surely they know you all over the world traveling with Public Enemy. Did the name change affect your career at all? Did, you know, some of your colleagues that you worked with for many, many years, did they kind of look at you different or question you about the name change, or did they just always know that you were with Minister Farrakhan?
No, some of them looked at it and said, very strange. Some people that I worked with were kind of annoyed. I think the first time Roger Mosley found out, it kind of like shook him up for a second. But, you know, he's a good buddy of mine, so I figured he'd handle it, you know, because he ain't no punk. And some others, you know, just they felt that it was a holdback. But I didn't look at it like that. I've been canceled or refused to have some play in some golf tournaments because of the affiliation with the minister. But, you know, that ain't no big thing to me, man. I ain't no great golfer, no how. But I don't think I've been trademarked or for any film or anything like that. I just stopped going to interviews. So it wasn't that they got mad at me or the minister. Just, I, you know, film come up tomorrow, tell my name Alex Clark, and I don't think nobody's going to say nothing unless you go to the wrong group of people. Then they might say something. But I'm not planning to go to the wrong group of people about no job.
You know, I want to ask you, because I know you and I have talked about this, but I want you to share, if you would, you know, you not just really gave up, but you just kind of turned away from the film industry to work with Minister Farrakhan, and you said that he did the same thing. Was that your inspiration?
No,
for,
had nothing to do with that. That was two
separate
individual decisions. You know, I didn't know him then, and, you know, I knew about that because, like I said, I spent a lot of time on private issues talking with him. So, but no, that had nothing to do with it. I just got tired of going to interviews. I don't know what he got tired of, but and interviews is part of that business. Now everything's on the computer and stuff like that, you know, so, you know, that's all. Just, if I do another movie, fine. If I don't ever do another movie, I ain't going to be mad at nobody.
Oh, okay.
But I know there's something there that I'm going to do, you know, or do my own, you know, so yeah, I'm all right. I'm not upset at any of them.
Okay, so you've been traveling with Public Enemy for, you said, 24 years now, correct?
Uh-huh.
And I want to ask you, because I know you've done some overseas tours, so is there a difference between how Public Enemy is received overseas versus at home? Is it the same? What's going on with that?
No, we're bigger overseas than we are here. We're big here, but this radio industry is scared to play our music because we're so political. Everybody else talk about, oh, bitch, kiss this, suck that, and that's not what we're doing. So we're real politically orientated. So you don't hear our stuff on the radio. They're scared of us. So we go overseas. You know, like you say, it's like a girlfriend. You get this one, don't work, and you go try to find you another girlfriend. So we work overseas a lot. We've done, I think we just finished up our maybe 85th, 86th world tour and getting ready to start our 87th in a couple of days. So we're well received overseas. You know, they love Public Enemy because they love the message. They love the lyrics. It's amazing that some of the things that they do, you know, with the tattoos and their whole bareback body with a Public Enemy tattoo. They, you know, we got a big following, especially Australia and New Zealand, where we got platinum and gold sales. We treat it well wherever we go. And there's always a couple up and downs in some towns. I know Greece, we have some problems every now and then in Tuscalona, but not Athens. But I don't know, maybe that's something personal. But we've done just about every country that we could without any, you know, true animosity. You know, there's a couple more I'd like to see, but, you know, we'll see what happens.
Yes, sir. So as it relates to the music industry now, Brother Malik, and, you know, I know you're with Public Enemy, and they, you know, produce a lot of positive music with a lot of positive messages, but then, you know, you come back here, and there's so much negativity and so much sexually explicit material. And, you know, has it ever come across your mind or the mind of those in Public Enemy to just maybe sit down with some of these up-and-coming rappers and just try to explain to them how the music industry itself has kind of whitewashed the lyrics of the, you know, the rappers now? Because, you know, we do a show on this network on Saturday called Young Gifted in Black. And that's for all of the Nation of Islam hip-hop artists who are doing or following in the footsteps of Public Enemy by, you know, putting a positive message out there. However, there's a struggle in getting that kind of music on the mainstream airplay, of course, on radio, and even distributed in music stores and things of that nature. They have their videos on YouTube, but the industry doesn't really pick that up because of the positivity in the message. And, you know, me and some of those artists, we were having a conversation, and one of the artists said, you know, we need to reach out and touch our people, but they are so untouchable. You know, when we talk about Lil Wayne and Rick Ross and Jay-Z and some of the other, you know, rappers who are, you know, just putting this bad stuff out here. Do you think a sit down would be a solution to kind of clean up the music? What do you think?
Oh no, that's a tough one. You know, we've had some sit downs with different groups, not the ones that you've mentioned, but you know, we've done it with the situation here in Los Angeles, the Skid Row. This past January, we did a show for them in hopes of trying to change that situation. But you know, it's a guy that's making $1 million a year don't want to sit down with you and hear about no change. You know, so what if we can get past that? And, you know, and it's a certain person that has to call these people to come, or they're not going to come. I think Chuck D can do it. I think Jim Brown can do it. I think Steve Harvey can do it. I think Jay-Z can do it. Females, I think Money Love can do it. MC Light, Missy Elliott, Yo-Yo, you know, it just certain people have to get it together because it's so far out, it's so far gone. We done made so many gains that we lost, and so it's got to be somebody real, and they got to really come to the table wanting to see change, you know, not see more money in the new cars and some jewelry. You know, they got to come and want to see change. Even when Mr. Farrakhan has them up in there stacked up like dirty clothes, we're only going to get so many of them. And he's the powerfulest voice in the world, other than God. So it's just, you know, it's got to be the right group of people. It's got to be the right time. And so you say, well, what is the right time, man? We're suffering right now. We need. You sure do. You sure do. You sure do. But you didn't think about that when you did that little dirty, nasty, little filthy show. Had girls' ass all over your little video and stuff. You didn't think about it then. And we don't know what y'all keeping on the footage that you don't show us on TV. You know, and the girls, they want work, they want jobs like everybody else. They lining up to get work, and it's tough, man. That's a tough one. I ain't gonna try to answer that one, baby. I'm really not. That's a toughie. It's just, but timing, and the right people putting it together, and we'll see some changes. You know, I hope it happens tomorrow. I hope that timing goes off tomorrow. You know, but it's something. I hope that during the Hall of Fame thing, we gonna say something in regards to that particular situation. Because of the way they've been trying to treat us since our induction coming up. You know, they playing dirty pool, but you know, that's all right. We don't have no problem with you playing dirty pool, because we just going to open up the clean glass and put that up there in front of you and go and do what we have to do. But I don't know what's going to, I don't think I have that ability, capability, the wisdom about, I don't know. I'm just going to try to do what Farrakhan tell me to do. So if they want to go elsewhere, then that's on them.
Yeah, sir. And so when is the date for the induction to the Hall of Fame for Public Enemy?
April 18th at the Nokia. They're probably short of HBO a week later, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
What is the 18th? 17th is a House of Blues show. 16th, we're going to be having press conferences and stuff at the Gibson Theater up on Figueroa down there near Olympic somewhere. And then we leave the country, like I said, on the 19th.
Yes, sir. Okay, so Brother Mike, what's in the future for you? Now, I don't know if you mind me telling, because you already said that you was born in 1944, so I'm just going to go ahead and put it out there. Now, you are 68 years old, soon to be 69 come May 6th. Mm-hmm. You are in excellent physical health and condition. You still pretty much look the same as you did 34 years ago, you know, and the gray just makes you more distinguished. So is there any plan to retire? You going to work till when?
Till Allah stop it. And I hope I'm wise enough to listen to him when he says stop. That's the best answer I can give you on that one. I'm Public Enemy. I'm close to slowing that one down. Maybe my son can get it from me. I don't know, but I'm about ready to let that one go. And then again, I could change my mind tomorrow. You know, it depends on what the next challenge is. I know I've got tremendous respect for Chuck, and I'm gonna try to take care of him as long as God bless me to take care of him.
If you do decide to pull back from Public Enemy, because I know you travel an awful lot, do you plan to do more films, or what is it that you're planning to do if you should decide to pull back?
I don't know. I have a lot of options. You know, you can produce, you can lecture, you can just go sit around the house, man, and play with the dogs. Oh, I don't know. I really don't. I just want to wake up every morning. That's all I want to do. Wake up every morning. Then I can do whatever I want to do.
Yes, sir. So. Okay. Well, you know, we have a mutual friend, Retta Zine, is doing a documentary on your life. And I had the pleasure of chatting with Retta, and he said that this documentary has taken 3 years to do. And tell us when we can expect to see it, and tell us what was covered in that 3 years. I don't know why it took 3 years, but for however long it took, what did you share with him, and what can we expect to see?
Pretty much of the stuff that we talked about, a lot of the stuff that we talked about this evening, he more or less covered the different things that I've done and how I've added to them. He got a chance to meet my family February of this year and film my family in Ohio. He had been filming me for the last 2 years, I guess, on different tours and places like that. They came here to L.A. and shot a lot of stuff. And sometimes then we ran out of budget money, so we had to put it on hold for a while. So I hope that they can come up with maybe a decent raw cut later on this month. I would hope. I'm not sure because I'm not involved in the editing or anything. I'm happy about it. And Griff Griffin is doing one here on me also here in Los Angeles. He's a former CBS CBS cameraman. And they're pretty close on the... they're different. They're different because Red is from Bologna, Italy, born in Morocco, and Griff is from Mississippi, living here. So they're going to be different. Some things may coincide, but I'm just hoping to get them both rolling before the end of this, before this 2013 is up.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir, absolutely. And, you know, I know you mentioned, and like I say, you know, you and Brother James, y'all kind of went ahead of me, but I'm going to ask this question again because I really want to know, Brother Mallet, because you are a father, you are a grandfather, and, you know, in our streets today, as it was slightly mentioned earlier, pardon me, there's a lot of gunplay going on in the streets today. There is a high incarceration rate for black males in particular today. And, you know, I know when you go back to your school in Alliance, Ohio, but again, you're all over the world. So when you can compare to how many blacks we lose here in the U.S. versus all over the world, what is that ratio? Is it the same with our people everywhere, or is this just part of the American nightmare?
Oh, that's a tough one, sister. I don't know. We got more black men in prison than we do in college. And we're killing each other at a rate that's not to be discussed. And, you know, I don't think it's something that you can just put your finger on. I don't think it's the amount of guns that's here. That's a whole not racial thing, but everybody's involved in that. You know, white folks, blacks, Puerto Rican, Mexican. But I don't have an answer for that. You know, I'm praying and hoping that Obama and his staff come to something that'll saute it. You would think that they have an equipment or a machine that could scan everything and know where all the guns are, and they have one. They have that capacity. I don't know if the NRA would allow it. You know, I guess NRA, I see it like they don't have power, but I'm just watching it on TV. It looks like they got a whole lot of power. And like I say, some people really are recreational about it, but it's the ones that are stolen that seem to be the ones that's getting us in a lot of trouble. So I don't know. I'm going to have to, they research it. You know, I ain't researched that, so I don't want to put my hand out there and try to make haste of it. I just know that it's bad. It's not good, and it don't look like it's going to stop tomorrow. So something's going to have to happen, and I don't know what it is. Like I say, I want to wake up every morning. If I wake up every morning, then I can try to help others wake up every morning. But I don't have an answer for that. I know the numbers and the stats, and like I say, New Jersey and Georgia and Chicago are just going absolutely crazy with crime and slavery. Really did a job on this. I mean, you got to really, really lay it out and try to figure out what it did. I mean, just the new father in the home. You know, I just feel so blessed that I grew up with a mother and a father. You know, that, you know, everybody didn't get that. Some made it, some didn't. You look at the NBA draft and the NFL draft, it's always the athlete and the mother. Very seldom do you see the father. That's painful right there. And look at all the trouble we had in the NBA and the NFL this year. It's crazy stuff, man. The money is too great. They're just not using it right. You don't have proper management telling you how to spend the money. Because, and I ain't knocking these guys because I didn't have anybody telling me how to spend money. I lost millions myself. It's because you didn't nobody tell you how to spend it. I mean, you know the best thing to go is real estate.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, everybody can't do that. You have to do what they do, you know. So, I don't know, man. I'm just praying today, man, that that we get a hold on it and that it stops. But, and then you got a whole bunch of people, sister, that's not trying to, that don't want it to stop. See, because the Ku Klux Klan, they don't have to put on no outfits now. They let us do it unto ourselves. You know, so it's a lot of madness going on out there. But, hey, we just have to keep
okay, hold on. Hold on 1 second, Brother Malik. This brother, I'm going to, if I can, DJ Black Caesar, can we make the mic live for area code 773?
At the phone wall, I only got no control over, you know, because it's a battery. The other one went off earlier, but I was able to go downstairs and pick up another phone, so I don't know how much battery life is left on it.
Oh, okay. All right.
So we just go see what happens.
Brother Frank, your mic is live. If you have a question for Brother Malik, go ahead. Brother Frank?
Yeah, I'm here. Somebody called.
What's wrong?
Walaikum salam.
How you feel, bro?
Fine, brother. How you doing?
I'm good, bro. Just, you know, what made you get into the industry, you know? My favorite movie was probably you did play a good role in that.
Thank you. I just got into it after having a frustrating football career in pro football.
Okay.
You know, just racism was just a little too hot for me. I figured I was going to get hurt or hurt somebody. So I just, you know, wait 3 or 4 years, and then I got on out of it. And films just seemed to be the next best thing to do to get notarized and make a couple dollars. So that's the one I chose.
Okay. So what are you doing now? I know you said you're not
Right now I'm just
so
working on
the
two
now?
Documentaries, and I'm handling security for Public Enemy. So I'm just busy right now, just traveling, making sure that they're
okay. Okay, so how long have you been doing the security for them? For a while?
I've been with them for about 24 years.
But it's been a lot. That's a good thing.
Thank you, man.
Keep your mind right, man.
Do the right thing, yes. Man. That's all. Just don't let no little ego and lack of knowledge, man, get you killed, get you hurt. Just, you know, some things you can't handle.
Yes.
You just have to walk away from.
Yes, sir.
Lack
yes,
of fight. Gotta walk away from him, man. Because everybody going to the trunk now. So if you ain't got nothing in your trunk, ain't no sense you fight. Especially if you win or lose. So just gotta use your head, man. 24/7, man. Gotta use your head all the time, man. Think you got kids, man. You gotta teach them every day. You know, just teach them to be better kids, man. Teach them some manners. Pull their pants up.
Yeah, it gets real crazy up here. You know, like I said, you know, we just gotta make an example for the young
That's
people.
Right. That's right. You sure do. It's their world.
The ministers going up. You know, the ministers going up to the young people. You know, that's what we try to do. So,
right.
You know,
that's good.
Thank a lot for you,
brother. I sure appreciate talking to you too, man. You be safe and take care of yourself. I look forward to meet you somewhere in the world.
Oh, yes, sir. You know, when you come to Chicago?
Chicago is. We got a show there, man. At the House of Blues. I think it's June 3rd or 13th or 11th. Somewhere in there in June, I think. We at the House of Blues. Just pull it up on the computer. You can find out Public Enemy. You know, Public Enemy on tour schedule. It'll show the date, Chicago.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure
okay.
it's on June somewhere. On June 3rd, 4th, 5th, 6th, somewhere in there.
Okay. Hopefully, yes, sir. I might wind up trying to get with you. You know, we
hope
can,
so, man. If you do, just find me. I hope Allah bless me. I'll be there. Just try to find me. I'll be there.
Yes, sir. And I appreciate you, brother.
Thank you so much.
Thank
I appreciate you also. Thanks, sis.
Yes.
Thank you, Frank. Okay. And I have another question in my inbox. Okay. Sister want to know. She said, don't say my name. Sister want to know, what did you think about the remake of Sparkle and the role of Satin Struthers played by Mike Epps?
Oh, I enjoyed the film, you know. I didn't go in there trying to look for something to be better than what we did. A classic is a classic, and a classic means that it was well-respected, well-received, and elongated by many people for a long time. I was unhappy that he didn't invite none of us for a cameo role or just a sit-down role or anything. But I ain't mad.
Mm-hmm.
I was unhappy because I thought it was unfair. But, you know, he's the producer. It's their money, and they make decisions on it. But again, I was sorry that they didn't utilize any of us because all of us are still living. That right there is good for a movie. But, you know, they chose not to. And like I said, I met him, and I wish him all the best of luck in the world, him and the wife. But I enjoyed it. I liked it, you know. I met Mike there. I've known Mike, you know. And I wish him the best, man. Ours was a classic. Hard to defeat a classic, so that people liked it, fine. If they did, that's on them also.
Yes, because I remember my son, he was like, Mama, you know, we know Sparkle, we know the whole thing from Precious Lord to Giving Up. They know the whole movie. And they say, my daughter say, Mama, I know everything Satin Struthers ever said in that movie.
So
and I was like,
likewise.
Yeah, I know. I know. And so, Brother Malik, I want to talk to you. I want to share with you because I know you said you didn't know. But, my passion is the youth because outside of working for the Department of Defense, I'm also a juvenile court advocate here in Brazos County. And, I run across the juveniles all the time. and trying to keep them out of prison. And I want to get back to that for a minute because, you know, whether you realize it or not, I know you do, that you are a living legend. And a lot of people, you know, may not know that, but you are a living legend. And, you know, I think, in my humble opinion, that you are such an inspiration to our young people, of what, you know, of an example of what to be and what not to be, and that you can delve into the entertainment industry and still be successful and still come out with your dignity and your pride intact. And you are just a perfect example of our black manhood. You are a gem amongst the FOI. You know, I want to know, when you encounter that young black man on the street, like you say, with his pants hanging off him, and, you know, he's tatted up and he's high or whatever, you know, when you encounter those young men, what is it that you say to them, and what do you suggest? You know, just in your opinion, just from being a father and a grandfather, you know, since there are no fathers in the home, 72% of black women do not have fathers in the home. They're single mothers. So what do you tell the mothers to tell their sons, even, in that situation?
You can't, you know, I don't know, man. I have a different opinion each time I see one. Sometimes I see a kid with his pants with Louis S. I say, he need beating the head with a stick. Or sometimes I might say, man, just go tell him to pull his pants up. But, you know, it's, the kids are so young and uneducated and dangerous, you know, you can get killed just trying to be politically correct. So a lot of times I don't tell you anything unless I'm just in an organized setting at a school or church or a fundraiser or something. But I don't try to walk out in the street and try to save them. I mean, we do things in the nation, you know, we go to certain areas and do certain things, but you really got to be careful, but you can't be afraid. You know, you got to be bold with it now, you know, because you're talking to some little young kids that are killers. You don't mind killing because they don't know the difference. They don't believe in fighting and shaking hands and stuff like that. So, you know, we could sit and ask questions all night that we don't have answers for. But like I said, if those people that I mentioned and you can get together and do some things like that, I'd be more than welcome to jump in there with them. You know, that's what the ministers have been doing. They've been traveling the cities and the neighborhoods and stuff. You know the problem in Chicago. And it's, you know, it's not an easy task, man. Sometimes your celebrityism don't mean nothing to them because they're not one. They don't understand. They just, who's he? What do he know? And about a kid not having that father, man, not hearing that strong, that deep voice, hey, man, that's something. I try to be father to as many kids as I can out here in California where I live. You know, just when you see it occurring, you try to sit down with a man and try to put some kind of sense in their head. You know, just, I don't have no daddy, blah, blah, blah. Okay, fine, now you do. But now, here's what you need to do. Try to do this, try to do this. Some of them listen, some of them don't. Some of them you kid, some of them you don't. Just the percentage is going to be greater, man. It just, even in my home, where I was born in Canton, man, they're doing a lot of killing down there in Canton. And we got a lot of strong black leaders down there, strong black school teachers, you know, Sandy Womack, Stephanie Patrick, two brilliant warriors down there that tried to keep the peace there. But these young kids, man, they're getting these little hot stolen guns, man. To them, it's like a firecracker, man. They just, you know, I mean, you look at TV sometimes, how can a person just shoot a person, man, in the back and then roll him over and shoot him four or five times in the head? I mean, God damn. You know? You know, fathers are just...
I know, Brother Malik.
Oh, sister,
I
sister.
Know.
It's so painful. It really is. It just really is, man. A kid don't even get a chance to go to school or kiss a girl or get married or nothing, man. It's just... It's wild, man. It's wild. It's wild. I know.
Well, I'm going to tell you that in the year 2013 already, since January 1st, we have lost over 2,400 youth between the ages of 10 and 24. Already, nationwide.
Wow,
2,400. And that's just the gun violence. That's not including accidents. That's not including
illness.
That's just gun violence. And, you know, I think that, you know, hopefully, you know, inshallah, you know, maybe we can get you, and maybe we can get Jim Brown, and maybe we can get Harry Belafonte, and maybe we can film a town hall meeting for the youth so that they can hear from brothers like you and like Jim and like Brother Harry Belafonte, and to get that direction, because, you know, it's not about being a biological father anymore. You know, a father is someone who, you know, who educates you, you know, who strengthens you, who teaches you manhood. And I think that the brothers going to have to understand, like, they're going to have to be the uncles. They're going to have to come in and take that place, because fathers are absent for so many reasons, you know, whether they're incarcerated or whether they are already deceased. You know, that death and destruction is becoming a generational cycle when you have a father that's a Crip and a son that's a Crip.
Yeah.
You know, that's sick. And so a lot of times, you know, the men have to, you know, come in and advise. And, you know, I was trying to figure out a way to really just get a message to, you know, black youth in the masses. And I think that's something that we're going to have to do. And maybe in the future you and I can talk about shooting that film with Harry and Jim, and getting that message out there.
Yeah, that'd be a nice idea. Yeah.
Yeah.
That'd be worth
I think that's what. Yeah, and inshallah, maybe we can get Minister Farrakhan to join us.
Yeah, I'll talk to Griff about it, you know, and see what we come up with.
Okay, so we're almost at the end, Brother Malik, and I know you're tired of talking. But I want to ask you something, because when I was interviewing you for this interview, you shared something with me that has stayed with me. And, you know, I hope I don't frustrate you by asking you this question, but I just found it very interesting what you said. Not in contradiction of anything that you said. I somewhat agree with you. But you said to me that you're not happy, and that you don't try to be happy, and that you get up every day and you're fine, but you don't try to be happy. And then you asked me, you said, do you think the minister is happy? And I want you, if you would, to share with our listening audience what you mean by that.
I mean, I've seen too much with my eyes. Maybe I shouldn't judge happiness by what I see. But how should I judge happiness? I mean, I'm a 68-year-old man that wakes up every morning, exercises, and have breakfast or whatever, and go to work, and come back home, and talk to your kids or visit your kids or call them on the phone, depending on wherever they're at. But I see too much. Happiness just ain't something that I talk about all the time. I mean, I'm fine, and that's good for me. I mean, I don't think I'm a lesser of a person because I'm not happy. There's probably 10 billion people that ain't happy for whatever their reasons might be. You know, I went to visit two of my friends the other day. The guy that sang Sincerely and Sparkle.
Remember that
song?
You told me he had a stroke.
I went to visit him and one of his best friends in the hospital. Now, that day, I was happy. To hold their hands and to watch them cry at why this brother come to visit me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they've been there for a couple of years. I didn't know where he was at until the day before yesterday. Now that I was happy to just be in there with them. But after I left, I was back to I'm fine. I did what I wanted to do. You know, I came in there and made two of my buddies pee on themselves with happiness at their brother coming to see them. You know, so I'm good. And they was glad to see me. I mean, they was glad. The lady said, this one ain't talked in a year or two.
Wow.
Down the way. And I just happened to bump into a guy we gave Otis Williams of the Temptations. We honored him the other night. And a guy just stopped me and asked me, was I Tony King? I said, yep. So I changed my name, but that's what it was. And then he said, you know, Artie? I said, Artie Smalls? Yeah, no. And we played ball together in the park. He said, man, he had a stroke. When I came in the room, I didn't know neither one of them by look from the stroke. But then I kept studying these faces. I said, damn, well, this one must be Artie. And this one must be Dave. This must be Dave. This must be Artie. Then they just got, I mean, they squeezing my hand like, you know, they squeezing the ring on my hand. My hands is hurting. I said, well, just let it go, God. That's what they got to do. And they were both in wheelchairs, big wheelchairs. Like maybe they sleep in them. Hey, so, you know, so, I mean, just, I was with Chuck D on the tour in Ireland last year. A guy came in, and the people that promoted the show, they wanted him to come in because they said he was a troublemaker. I said, let me decide on that, okay? So the promoter girl said, we don't want him in the room. So I went in and talked to him in his private room, rubbed him in, hugged him, pat him down, make sure he wasn't carrying no weapons. And he showed me a picture that he drew of Chuck. So I took him in the room and showed him the picture. I said, Chuck, look what this guy did to you. He said, Chuck, I was going to kill my mother yesterday until I heard your lyrics. And I drew this rather than kill my mother. How in the hell am I supposed to be happy? Unless I'm judging happiness. Like I say, if I'm judging happiness on the wrong criteria, then that's a different story. Me and my wife got to talking about it the other day. She kept saying, I mean, we argued about it. I said, baby, please, I don't want to argue about that. I ain't happy. Leave me alone. I'm fine, though.
And another thing I want you to share with us before you go, because I think, you know, a lot of people don't talk about it, but it's absolutely the truth, and that is the lack of respect for our dear brother President Barack Obama. You know, share your views with that, with us on that.
Well, you know, it's I said, man, the white man gonna be white. He can't be nothing else, you know. And they just a nigga to him for the most part, you know. They just they don't really, they know what they got, but they ain't gonna never let us know. I mean, and his wife, she's smarter than him. He worked for her, and they don't know. They don't really know. Some of them do, but you know how they are. They're a different breed of people, you know. God knew what he was doing when he brought them up in here, and they just. I mean, call him Brock. Call his wife Shell. Say the first lady. And then they apologize, and then the white folks just let him go. It's okay. Or call him a nigger, or make a little niggerish cartoon joke. Or that was just a new cartoonist. We don't mean to mean nothing by that. Oh, man. They just mad. They just mad. Man, but I tell you, he's as cool as ice. He's as cool as that. And that's all it is, man, just a black man running the country. Ain't about nothing else. Ain't about nothing else. And they're going to keep him hell with this gun law. And that'll make or break him. But we'll really see what kind of, we'll really see where his heart is. You know, hey, they'll, you know, that's a tough law. That's a tough thing. People ain't trying to give up their gun. A lot of people think that if they give up their gun, a black person will come kill them. Because this can't happen anyhow because of what they did in slavery. So, shit, you know, they ain't trying to give up their weapons. So I just say, hey, man, hey, look at what they, you better try to see tomorrow. You better try to see tomorrow. But he's the best I've seen. He's the best I've seen. He really been a remarkable president. I'm so thankful. I didn't ever think I'd get to see it. I really didn't, man. I'm glad my mom got to be part of it. My father missed it by a minute or two. But that's the way it go. But he's a blessing. He is a blessing. And I pray for him,
your dog
every day.
Your dear mother is still with us, and so she has to be very, very proud of you. How is she?
She's fine. Yeah, she's definitely proud of her boys and that sister of ours. You know, she's been a blessing also. She never chose. She was a great athlete, too. But she just wanted to like to take care of babies, run her nurseries and stuff like that. So we bless her. She's in the middle. She's a baby. She's the youngest. And we're a year apart, the three of us. And mom's just had her 90th, and she's doing real good. She's a warrior. She's a bona fide warrior.
And where is Brother Charlie these days?
He's in Selma, Alabama, him and his wife.
And what did he do after football?
He worked for a Champion paper company in Independence, Ohio for about 20 years. They bought him out. Then he went into the limousine business. Now him and his wife is in real estate business down there, a lot of property in Alabama. They're building a cemetery, I think, now. So yeah, he's okay, you know. He's hanging in there.
Okay. All right. Well, Brother Malik, I tell you that I am beyond honored. I am so grateful that you were so gracious and so willing to do this interview. I cannot express to you how honored I am to finally meet you after 34 years of tracking your career and looking at all of your movies, and then to find that you are my brother in faith and in spirit. It has really, really been a remarkable week for me, being able to talk to you and get to know you. And I tell you that I am so, you know, I mean, I know I'm a lot younger than you, but I am so proud of you, and I am so proud of the work that you're doing. I'm proud of the work that you have done, and I'm proud of the work that you continue to do. And brother, I want you to know that if no one else tells you, you are definitely a living legend, and I'm gonna do my part to make sure that people know who you are and what you have contributed to the entertainment as well as the sports industry, and just as a good brother and humanitarian. I cannot thank Allah enough for you and, of course, your team, your staff, for working with me this week as well in making this interview happen. It's the interview of a lifetime for me, and I am to the moon, and believe it or not, it's almost 2 hours in, and I'm still nervous.
Oh, it'll be all right.
Even though it's almost over. So anything you want to share with us before we go? Because I'm going to play a song for you, and it's one that I think you're going to remember. But is there anything else you want to share with us before you go?
No, I just want to thank you and thank the audience, the listening audience. And, just don't judge me on what I say. Just try to judge me on the things that I do, because we all make some mistakes sometimes verbally. We may say some things that you might not like or that you don't understand, but I didn't say anything to bring any harm to anybody, any race, any persons. I just called it like it is. And if you can't handle the truth, that I'm the wrong person to be trying to talk to. But thanks for the time and the energy and the effort put out in the interview and all of that. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, dear brother. And I'm going to play this song, and this is by a good friend of yours, Bennett McKee. And I'm going to see if you remember that. For my listening audience, thank you so much for sharing this special night with us. May Allah continue to bless us all. Assalamu alaikum. One nation, one love. This one's for you, Brother Malik, from the movie Sparkle. By Bennett McKee. Thank you, Brother Malik. Much love to you, dear brother. May Allah continue to bless you and keep you and your family.
Thank you.
Oh. Thanks, man.
To be shy about, nothing we got to lie about. Oh, loving you don't confuse you. Oh, baby, baby, I don't wanna lose you. And when we touch, our hearts move in a steady pace.
Ooh, ooh, yeah,
I'm trying.
Good night.
Thank you.
All right.
Assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum.